everybody.
Hi, listeners.
Welcome to episode 31. That's not as exciting as episode 30. It's not a round number, but...
I find that even more exciting, though, because it's like we could have cleanly just ended it at 30.
That's so true.
And instead, we're going to keep doing our best every day, which is many people's worst.
Yes. But we could be resting on those laurels, and we're not. I'm going to tell you what we are doing. We're going to have such a good afternoon, morning, evening... Time is a flat circle.
True.
With our guest today. Our guest today is an esteemed Boston playwright. I don't toss that word around. Esteemed, girl, all right? His plays include The Haberdasher, Brawler, Chalk, and a play we'll be talking about a lot today, Non-Player Character, which was a finalist at the 2016 Eugene O'Neill Playwrights Conference.
Damn, Eugene.
It had its world premiere at the Bay Area Playwrights Festival. And top of that, how does he find the time? He co-hosts the fabulous podcast Crossover Appeal, the only podcast we want you to listen to besides ours.
Woo!
Ladies, gentlemen, everyone, people, the pets in the background listening, please welcome Walt McGuff.
My dog really appreciates the shout out.
Oh, I know.
Your dog is very cute. Anytime he ends up on social media, I'm thrilled.
Yeah, so he's cute. Got a robust presence.
He really does.
Which, as a ratio of the amount of time he sleeps, is actually pretty impressive. So.
Wow. That's the dream. Honestly, that's a huge mood for me, is I'm either on Twitter or I'm asleep.
It helps to have Annie, my wife, who is very excited about Bodo, doing all of his PR for him.
Yes.
So she's very good at it.
And Annie co-hosts your podcast.
She does.
Right? So shout out to her.
Yeah.
Hi, Annie
Cardi. She's amazing.
Is she going to listen to this episode, or is she going to be like, I hear enough of you, Walt.
I'm sorry. I'm done. No.
Marcus, please.
Well, why don't you just tell us what we're going to be talking about today?
Absolutely. Today, because I want to talk about horrifying things, we're going to be talking about Gamergate.
No.
I know.
Boo, bad.
Right? Yeah. Hey, Sam and Allie, do you two like video games?
Medium?
Less than medium.
Less than medium?
Rare.
Yeah. No, but Allie, you see, you're right, because neither of you do, because you're women.
And that's true.
The internet,
that's correct.
As far as the internet is concerned, no. Just no.
No.
I'm so excited to be in this sexist role play right now.
Oh, God, no.
My lady eyes can't even understand computers, you know?
Oh, no.
I look at a screen with a video game and I'm just like, there's so many colors.
It is amazing that I can get this podcast off the ground, because the truth is I cannot read.
Wow.
So, yeah.
You're an inspiration.
I am an inspiration.
So, yeah, Gamergate, I can just dive right into it.
Please
if we
do.
Want to start feeling terrible about things.
Oh, I'm ready.
Yeah. I mean,
felt too good today. Mm-hmm, let's ruin it.
Absolutely.
Let's do it.
Great. So, Gamergate, as a term, kind of refers to like everything and nothing, but also one very specific thing that then blew up into about a billion thousand other things, most of which involved women, non-binary people, and people of color being horrifically abused on the internet, which I feel like is a story that's way more common nowadays than it should be.
Yeah, that sounds like classic internet to me.
Yeah, it's really just internet. I mean, Gamergate, in a lot of ways, I feel like the lesson to take from this is it is a microcosm of internet.
Mm.
In
all
a lot of
internet.
Ways. Yeah.
And we just talked about the dark web.
Oh, yeah.
So this is dark in a different way.
Yeah, this is like what makes the web just a dark place.
And it's surface web dark.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone who listened to episode 29 will get it. And the rest of you can just fry the rest of the episode.
Oh, I thought you were just going to say the rest of them could just fry. end of sentence. And I felt like that was not a good way to...
No.
No.
No, that's not what I meant.
No, we love to alienate listeners here on this podcast.
I don't know
if that's what you guys
No, it's a solid strategy. I like it. So with Gamergate, I mean, I'm not... like full expert or anyone who is directly involved in Gamergate. So there's a lot of generalities and basic sort of overview stuff that we're going to talk about tonight. But I will probably get at least a couple things wrong. But I'll try to give you a basic idea of the whole thing. So I thought a good place to start would be the kind of generally understood video game specific background of what sort of the conditions on the ground were that bred Gamergate. So what I find that my sort of personal take on video games and what I both love about them and find fascinating about them is that they are an art form and an artistic medium that is based, at least originally, entirely on competition. So like you're really only like running Mario through the world to score points if you're a particular kind of person or if you're a designer. Like there's always a gamification. And so video games are something that have this competitive side of them baked in from the beginning of the medium, and way early in the days of the medium, because of where technology was, that was really all you could get into the game. Mm-hmm. There just wasn't like a lot of space or processing power to do more than like, here's your Pong paddles.
Yeah.
We're playing against each other.
I saw that at my dad's house once.
Yeah? Pong?
Yep.
That might be worth something now. Does he still have it?
I have no idea. I was so uninterested, I was probably threw it somewhere.
That's fair. It's a pretty uninteresting game, but man, did people love Pong.
Yeah. Or it's like, I'm a gorilla and I'm throwing barrels at you.
Right. Well, I mean, technically you're defeating the gorilla who's throwing barrels at you.
All right. We're going to start the man.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
I'm saying I'm the enemy in the game.
Oh, my God. I would play that game. Yeah.
It's just me as
just,
I am.
Just I'm throwing them barrels.
Tossing barrels at you.
Yep.
You just have to reason with me. You can't.
It's true. It's just like, sit down. There's some anger issues being expressed. And yeah, I don't know. That feels more like a modern day game.
That's true.
Beautiful, empathetic maybe place for other gamers to go.
Right?
Who aren't as competitive.
Exactly.
I imagine.
And that's actually something that I think, you know, mass market video games started as this, like, their Pong or their Galaga, or I mean, they started in arcades. And so a big part of arcades was like, you're playing to beat the other people and get your three initials or like poo up on the leaderboard, depending on how you were feeling. As the technology evolved, like, you started to get to do more stuff and you started to get games that had narrative in them because they could do enough different things to build a narrative in. But even then, it was very archetypical. So it was like, you're saving a princess, or you're, you know, beating the evil aliens, and you're, it's really like everything is boiled down to like good and evil. There's not a lot of nuance. And that was sort of the way that games developed as a form and as storytelling. I feel like as a lot of storytelling does. But what it meant was that you had this competitive art form that was really super basics, that then started to codify the way that it told stories. While you got the technology increasing and you got a lot more people trying to sort of push the boundaries in other directions. So you started to get like indie gaming scenes really early on as people tried to figure out different approaches and ways to play around with games. But the ones that were making money were all the sort of mainstream games. That moves very into the 90s and early 2000s, but especially the 90s, when it sort of became codified that all of the consumers that games companies were interested in were like your 16 to 35 year old white boys. Mm-hmm. Like, that was just, all of them were like, hey, this is our market now.
Yeah.
So I think that started to get more and more codified, and it especially was happening while the internet was happening. And so all of the conversations around gaming were largely mostly men talking about these games that were marketed to men and for men and designed by men generally. And the gaming press, such as it was entirely enthusiast. It was like Nintendo put out Nintendo Power magazine. And it was like these magazines that were trade magazines of like, look at the cool games you can buy. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the limit of the engagement. Then, especially as the internet grew and games grew, you started to get more access to and awareness of games that were doing different stuff. Mm-hmm. And people started, who had grown up playing video games, started creating video games and trying to sort of push it a little bit, because you don't want to just make Pong for the rest of your life or make Super Mario Brothers. You start to change it. And there started to be more room in the medium as a field, more perceived room for people who were not the standard gamer. But there was still this major market push to really just define a gamer as a dude, and a white dude with disposable income, especially. And so you started to get this divide of like mainstream games versus indie and hardcore gamers, which were like the guys who played Doom and Call of Duty when it happened, and Halo, versus casual games of like games that are not made to just blow stuff up. And so, and even for the people who were not dudes or white dudes who played hardcore games, they didn't exist as far as the games were concerned. They were not the ones being marketed to. They just happened to enjoy them because a lot of them are really well-made games. So there was kind of this weird toxic environment happening around entitlement and the idea that you had a whole swath of people, many of whom were moving into the industry, who had been told their entire lives that they were the only important demographic in existence. And then they started being faced with other games putting out there because of increases in distribution models and other ways to access games. And they started seeing games that were not specifically made for them. And that freaked them out because guys are scared of stuff that's not for us.
Yeah.
Just, it's It's madness. Why? Why would you do that? And it's the kind of thing that happens across any media, but as with so much of what Gamergate was and became, it was the same dynamics that exist playing out in a field with largely anonymous people and no accountability or social filter whatsoever.
Oh, good.
So, you know, you take all of that pent up fragile masculinity and fear, and then you allow someone to express it in a way that will never hold them accountable for their own thoughts or feelings. And it's a great time and everybody loves it.
Yeah, I remember a little bit of my brother. I have an older brother, so even though I am a woman who is laden with breasts, unfortunately, I do have an older brother who played all of those kind of like war-y games. And I think my parents didn't fully understand what it meant to let him hook it up to the internet and like talk on chat over headphones.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Because when they weren't home, he wouldn't put the headphones in. And it was just... It was like you were listening to the apocalypse of language. It was just horrific.
Absolutely.
It was so bad.
And it's such a gatekeeping function of like anything that involves crowd interaction just becomes a way for people to shut people out of their hobby. I mean, it's the equivalent of like the guy at the comic book shop quizzing you on what your favorite superhero is if you try to buy a comic, because you're trying to carve out and protect this space that you see as yours. Mm. So a lot of that was going on already and had been going on for years. And at the same time, the growing indie scene was starting to get noticed by the growing games journalism scene that was separate than just like your straight up trade reviews. Yeah. It wasn't just like, hey, get this game, it's good. We like the people who did it and they gave us a bunch of free stuff. You were getting sites and critics starting to actually look at games as an art form because you had people like Roger Ebert saying games are not an art form. And so then the internet went nuts and everybody started trying to prove that it was an art form. But when people started to treat it like one, there was a lot of pushback and a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm. So into this field, minefield comes a lot of people, but especially the sort of central figure of Gamergate, who is Zoe Quinn. So Zoe Quinn was an indie game designer who in 2013 put out a game called Depression Quest. Depression Quest was a text-based game, so there were no graphics. It was just like an old MS-DOS terminal. You were typing in commands, and it was constructed to replicate the experience of depression. So you would get choices or scenarios, but like as you were playing, certain choices would get grayed out, or you would no longer have the option to like reach out to a friend or something because the depression was limiting you. And it was a very sort of small, intimate game, and it was based on her own experiences, but because it was utilizing a game mechanic to tell a story in a different way, it got some notice in the general press, and people started talking about it. Mm-hmm. And because Kotaku, the same website that was talking about Call of Duty or Halo, also would occasionally run an article on something like Depression Quest, gamers went nuts. People were like, no, this is, you're putting politics into our games and you're not letting our game just be fun anymore and all of this. And
I love your incel accent. It's amazing.
Yeah, right. I've really been honing it.
It is sharp.
Oh, man. I've done an unfortunate amount of research.
Yeah, I feel unsafe in this.
No. Oh, man.
And you hit it. It's great.
That's it. I love the idea that like depression only happens to liberal cucks. Like,
yeah.
Oh, absolutely. No. It's like, why would anybody be depressed otherwise? It's just weakness.
Yeah, exactly.
There were a number of games. It wasn't just Depression Quest. It was also, there were a number of other games. One of the biggest ones was called Gone Home, which was a genre that people trying to make fun of these types of games started labeling as walking simulators. It was the idea that like you're playing a game from within a character perspective and you're exploring an environment. And like in Gone Home, it's you come home from college and your house is empty and you're walking through the house, piecing together what happened to your family. And it's sort of this. And
it's fun.
It's really cool. It's really cool. And it's really lovely storytelling. Like it builds a narrative, but it builds it interactively. But you didn't shoot anybody, so people hated it. Very specific people hated it. And they were the specific people who had been told for the last 20 years that this was their thing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
So Quinn already, even before what is generally referred to as Gamergate happened, was receiving death threats and abuse and all of this stuff on Twitter, which many people had been receiving because Twitter and the internet are Twitter and the internet. But Quinn would push back. She would publicize the amount of abuse she was receiving. She would talk about it. She was public with it, which would then just kind of increase the feedback loop of it. But it was very important to her to push back to it. This all came to a head with something called the Zoe Post. The Zoe Post was published by Quinn's ex-boyfriend, who, after they had broken up, published a 10,000-word long post about her and about specifically how untrustworthy and what a, you know, any number of slurs she was, including private text and Facebook conversations and replications of that, and the whole basic overview of it was this woman is terrible and you shouldn't trust her for any number of reasons. It's a shit show. It's like the worst thing in the world to read.
I read it and it bummed me out for about 6 days.
Right?
It's the fact that it existed.
It's just a bummer. And it was workshopped. Like it was done. Oy. He worked with other people. He sent drafts to people to specifically figure out like what's the best way to do this. He published it on a number of forums, including like Penny Arcade and a few other forums where it was immediately deleted because people were like, dude, this is insane. So then he put it up on a WordPress blog and started posting links to it on Reddit and 4chan and other sites that have way less stringent content control and
Reddit?
Moderation.
Never.
I know, right? Who knew?
If Reddit falls, we all shall.
But I mean, in a lot of ways, though, compared to 4chan, Reddit is like a utopia. Like,
it's the gentleman's 4chan.
Yeah, it's like the Utah. of the internet.
But yeah, so this post happened as it was designed to, and incited a whole lot of assholes to latch onto it and start coming after Zoe. And specifically buried in this 10,000-word screed was the implication that Quinn had slept with a games reporter for Kotaku named Nathan Grayson in order to get positive reviews of Depression Quest. No one going after her for that was bothered by the fact that Grayson had never written a review of Depression Quest.
Oh my God.
And had only mentioned it once in an article, in like a list article before he and Quinn started dating. That doesn't matter. That's fake news.
Yeah, fake news.
So that sort of started it. It made its way into 4chan. Everything blew up and Quinn started getting attacked consistently. It was referred to for a long time as the Quinnspiracy because branding. But then, hey, how do you two feel about Firefly, the TV show Firefly?
Sam, I feel like you know more.
I am a big fan of the TV show Firefly.
Can I ruin it for you a little?
Okay.
All right.
Too basic for the both of you.
Must you?
So it was known as the Quinnspiracy for a long time until the term Gamergate was utilized by Adam Baldwin, who played Jane in Firefly.
Oh, I heard he was a dick, but yeah. I was hoping he wasn't.
No, he's way into Dickville.
Man. Good. Can never watch that episode again where they make a statue.
I know,
of him.
Right? And the hats just feel so much worse now. So yeah, that's his contribution to culture post-Firefly.
Jesus Christ.
The term hashtag Gamergate.
Jesus Christ.
around that time that this post was being, or this movement, I'm doing really aggressive air quotes right now. by the time this was getting adopted by celebrities and people were pushing it, it was already undergoing a little bit of rebranding because people decided going after my ex-girlfriend because I don't like her anymore is not as strong of a hook to get the rest of the internet involved as making this about ethics in journalism, specifically ethics in games journalism. This became the like banner war cry of Gamergate that they weren't actually concerned about Zoe. It was that Quinn was indicative of this rot, this moral rot within games journalism that all these developers were just sleeping their way to the two articles on Kotaku, and that was destroying journalism or games as a whole. So that was the moral ground they were standing on. And they started this kind of branding, essentially, and putting out this image of Gamergate as, well, actually, it's about ethics and journalism. So that the great part of it was you could abuse somebody and then they would push back on you. And then like five other people would come in and say like, well, why do you want games journalism to be corrupt? What's your problem? Like, why would you defend this person? They're just part of the problem. And it became this weird perpetual motion machine of hedging bets and abuse. So that happened, and then it started to grow and encompass a number of other people. Especially a couple of the biggest were Anita Sarkeesian, who runs the YouTube channel Feminist Frequency.
Sam and I are huge fans. Mm-hmm. I've seen all of the videos that I hope you're about to talk about, and they absolutely blew my mind, and I was just sending them to everyone I knew. And I just feel like still when I'm having conversations about sexism, misogyny, media representation, every mm-hmm. time I'm having any kind of conversation encompassing any of those topics, I find myself parroting quotes from her videos just because they are so eloquent and so just on, like, nail on the fucking head every single time.
Yeah. Tropes versus Women is just like,
it's brilliant.
The best series.
Yeah.
So good.
And she had done the original Tropes versus Women series and was kickstarting Tropes versus Women in video games, mm-hmm. which was she wanted to do a series of videos about the way that narrative tropes are baked into so much of video games. And this Kickstarter got a massive amount of negative attention because, again, it was someone dealing with video games as a critical object, which hardcore gamers felt was a personal attack. It was this perceived as this like, well, no, you can't tell us that we're bad because we like these bad games. And, you know, Sarkeesian's whole point was you can like something and still engage with it critically. Mm-hmm. And this was sort of, really all of the Feminist Frequency stuff is very like ground level media criticism. That's not, it's very like lovingly assembled and very attentive, but also not super like high level challenging. She's not saying anything that is hard to agree with, but she was saying about video games, and mm-hmm. that was something that had not gotten that treatment before. And so people went nuts. The Kickstarter, because of the abuse she was getting, massively overperformed, mm-hmm. Which just made people even madder. And she was already, because of that, she was already on Gamergate's radar when Gamergate started getting going. The fact that they were attacking her, who was a person who did not work in games journalism, would seem to hurt the argument that this was all about ethics in games journalism. But again, not really caring about that. Another person who got hit really hard was Brianna Wu, who is a game designer who ran a company called Giant Space Cat, who jumped in and sort of defended and pushed back against Gamergaters, and so brought a ton of abuse on herself and got driven out of her home. Lee Alexander was a games journalist who wrote an article basically about the idea of the gamer identity being a thing that needed to die. The thing of like the centralized idea of a gamer being this white guy ready to play a shooter being the only demographic that was played to. She wrote an article that was very understandably angry at the existence of that idea and pushing back on it, and then got a wave of abuse because of it. And then there were, I mean, the insidious part of Gamergate, among many, were that there were the main headliners, sort of the people who had cachet already, who were sort of a little famous, mm-hmm. getting these abuse, and they were able to publicize the way in which they were being attacked. But then there's a whole sea of people completely unseen getting the same treatment without the resources or the background or whatever. So there were a massive number of games journalists, gamers, just regular people, especially people of color, especially gender nonconforming people, disabled people, getting just buried under these waves because these were coordinated attacks. And the second someone spoke up or pushed back, they would just get buried under things. So you had people like Tariq Musa and Maddie Bryce, who were critics writing about games, who just got inundated by things. And then a bunch of other people who we've just never heard of because there were a lot, and it was a very asymmetric kind of warfare. Types of abuse that people were getting: rape and murder threats, doxing, which is the publication of your home address or phone number. It was like people would get like a photo of their door sent to them.
Ah,
like their front door.
That's horrific.
By an anonymous account.
Oh
yeah.
My God. Imagine just tweeting like, maybe we should be nice to women. And the next day it's like, I'm in front of your house.
Right.
Exactly. Ready to kill you. Yes. Poised to do that.
Yeah. Swatting was another behavior, which is you call the police department and claim that there's a hostage situation going on at someone's house so that the SWAT team shows up and knocks down their door.
I've heard of that. That's one of the most horrifying things ever. Mm-hmm.
I think actually in the last couple of months, someone was actually killed in a swatting. But it's been very, very close a number of other times. Like, it's the kind of thing that just it's bound to happen. Constant phone calls. Quinn got her Wikipedia entry edited to reflect a time of death. A big, huge part of it was hacking of any personal accounts that people had, Twitter, email, Facebook, because people would just mass try to break into their account and then pull and scrape anything they could to then use against the person. Going after family members, parents, loved ones, anybody would get pulled in and start getting abused as well. I think it was Lindy West, journalist.
I love her.
Yeah, she's amazing. I'm pretty sure it was her. Someone started tweeting at her as her dead dad.
Jesus Christ.
You gotta
admire
terrible.
The creativity of absolute fucking pieces of shit.
Right?
And just the free time on their hands.
Mm-hmm. I know, honestly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really horrifying. Oh God, I did it. I got a ding.
Got the ding. We both just made a face. We're proud of you.
Yay,
you're really a part of the horrified fam now.
Well, you've been working for it.
I know. I'm glad that I earned my way in. You know, I'm glad I didn't do it on purpose.
Yeah.
I just felt like it would have cheapened the whole thing.
Yeah, it has to be organic.
Mm-hmm.
Some people just come out the gate, but we respect you more.
Oh, absolutely. I appreciate that. Yeah. I appreciate that. People would build games. There was a Punch Anita Sarkeesian game.
I saw
where
that.
You could Punch Anita Sarkeesian. And Quinn wrote a memoir called Crash Override, which is amazing and very, very worth reading it. She actually describes a lot of it in one of the paragraphs. I just pulled a quote that I really like in that it's terrible. The situation kept escalating with new threats to my online presence and physical safety pouring in. Sleep felt too risky. It was impossible to look away. Trying to mitigate the damage when thousands of people were continually finding new ways to torment me took enormous amounts of time and energy. Trying to report every new threat that came in from any social media platform quickly became impossible and pointless because by the time I would finish reporting one threat, three more would have taken its place. So it's just this iterative inundation of terrible treatment. Gamergate, you know, sort of keeps burning like this out of sight for a few months. I mean, largely unnoticed in the mainstream media because it's largely games personality isn't happening on Reddit and all of that. Eventually, Sarkeesian canceled a speaking event in October 2014 that was at Utah State University. There was a threat called in to the university if the event were to move forward, and the university refused to provide heightened security. So Anita Sarkeesian was like, well, that's bad, so I'm not going to show up. So she canceled it, and that is finally the thing that made Gamergate sort of hit the mainstream. That started getting written about, people started talking about it more. And it also caused it to blow up even more because now all of a sudden everybody had an opinion about it. So things went really crazy and ethics and games journalism kind of metastasized into the cause of like gators everywhere. Journalism sites, especially games journalism sites, were very slow to respond because they were being accused of corruption, but they also were a trade organizations and they were operating under the assumption that the majority of their readers were Gamergate sympathizers.
Oh. Yeah. I didn't think about that.
Right. And so, like, because nobody was talking about anybody else who played games. Mm-hmm. Like, it was common knowledge that the only people who read games press were, like, gamers. And why would anybody else spend time on this? So there was a lot of pussyfooting around it. A lot of, like, game sites would draft sort of codes of ethics to show the ways in which they would responsibly handle things. And it was also like it was a trade press being forced to confront the way that it operated in a way that they weren't used to, but also being confronted in incredibly bad faith. So, you know, it was just this whole morass. Even worse were the games companies who just for the most part didn't respond at all. Because if you're making a game, your marketing department doesn't want you to isolate what they see as half of your demo, if not all of your players. So the whole log line on it was just don't be political. Just don't wade into it. Just stay out and ride it out, despite the fact that developers, players, fans. I mean, everybody was being dragged into this, and everybody was just trying to turn a blind eye to it.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Need a break from the horrifying reality of real life? Well, do we have a sexy deal for you.
Go to adamandeve.com and use our special code HORROR for 50% off almost any item and free shipping. That's HORROR at checkout for 50% off and free shipping. Order now and get ready to...
So this intersected with like all of the actual social background around toxic masculinity and entitlement and opportunism. Elliot Rodger and the University of Santa Cruz shooting was around this time, a guy who shot up a sorority. Because,
yeah, we talked about that.
Oh,
in
that's
our past
right.
Episode.
That's right. So, yeah. So this was all happening around the same time. The men's rights activism movement was happening. Anti-Semitism and white supremacy was on the rise because of social media. And all of these movements were intersecting with Gamergate because Gamergate was essentially developing a toolkit for abuse online.
Wow.
Ways to coordinate attacks and then fade back into the darkness without losing any real ground. And it all became wrapped up in this idea of like, we're pushing back against the social justice warriors. You know, we got to own the libs basically at every opportunity. And that's all that matters. There's an amazing video series online by Innuendo Studios. It's like a 5-part YouTube series called Why Are You So Angry? That uses Gamergate as a jumping off point to talk about this kind of reactionary anti-SJW mindset, because it's this idea that if you tell me something I like is problematic, I'm going to hear that as you telling me I'm bad. And so I don't like that feeling because it means that then I have to make a choice. I have to either keep liking this thing because it's problematic or I have to stop liking it.
You're like thrown into this bathtub of cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, exactly.
And then what do you do?
And it's like, and it's possible there's a third option, which is continue to like the thing while acknowledging what it could do better. But it's hard to see that nuance when you first get hit with this is what's wrong with it.
And I can understand that.
Oh, absolutely.
That's something that's totally understandable.
Yeah. It makes a massive amount of sense as a knee-jerk reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think what defines someone who's able to like continue working in society is someone who can then work past the knee jerk and actually moderate. But a lot of people take the other option of retreating into the feeling of being attacked. And what Gamergate offered was a whole mass of people saying, no, you're right. These people are wrong. And because of that, you basically had this core constituency of Gamergate who were abusive and were the real active abusers, covered as this operating as the sort of donut hole of this even larger group of people who thought they agreed with the basic premise and might not have felt great about the abuse, but also felt like they agreed more with what the abusers were trying to do than with the target. And so the abusers could come in, yell at someone, threaten someone online, and then fade away while the person tried to fight back against them, but actually got mobbed by all these people trying to have reasonable debate with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it,
and they're like, I'm past reasonable debate.
Right.
I have had my life threatened.
Right. They're like, this
I'm
is
not
interested
in debating.
Right. This is not an exchange of ideas that we're having. Like, this is not, you're not coming in with good faith.
Mm-hmm. Which reminds me of a quote, which I think might be from Jesus or something, which is, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem.
Mm. Yeah.
Who said that?
Probably Jesus.
Just all teachers everywhere. Everyone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's applicable,
yeah,
for sure.
It's like the simplest idea, and it's bleeding over into every shit show that we talk about here, every shit show that's happening everywhere.
And it's that blend of like reactionary anger is so mutable that it can look like whatever you want it to look like, while it is also doing stuff that's completely unforgivable. And it's why, you know, all of the like calls for civility now are such a load of crap, because it's this idea that like you can't be civil with someone who's attacking you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like they've already given up the ground, but what about all the people who are their friends? Why can't you just be civil to them? Well, because they're friends with the guy who's attacking you. It also, I think, revealed a lot of this myth-making around the identity of like a nerd and geek ownership, because it was something that never actually existed. Mm-hmm. I think you got a lot of cultural critics and political critics wading in on the Gamergate issue and doing really terrible takes because of a basic misunderstanding of what nerd culture was. I think the choicest one for me was Andrew Sullivan, who I spent way more time reading after college than I should have. But a huge part of me realizing like, oh, this guy has some really bad ideas, was his approach to things like Gamergate. You had a lot of people who have never played a video game all of a sudden saying, well, you know, all these boys have just grown up playing this game. And I think a direct quote from Andrew Sullivan was, but bullying has occurred on both sides, but only one side was bullied before. This idea that boys growing up, if they're gamers, were getting bullied and games were an escape, which is true to some extent for a number of people, but also ignores all of the people who also played games and were bullied by gamers. Mm-hmm. That yeah. There were plenty of girls and white and non-white boys and people who played games who were not only excluded from general culture growing up, but also excluded from games culture.
Mm-hmm. And nerd culture.
Right, and nerd culture, and not allowed to take part in that. Mm. And they're not the aggressors in the situation. And so you got all of this stew around that, which has continued into today. I mean, Gamergate basically was the template that the alt-right used in its rise. You see things like the Google Manifesto by James Damore of this like pushback on diversity, equity, and inclusion in the workplace. It's all the same argument, but Gamergate was the first one to have it because there were so few filters. The games industry is still having a massive amount of trouble with it. There was a big expose in the last month or so about Riot Games, which makes League of Legends, which is like a big, massively multiplayer game, combat game. The player base is largely male. The company is like 80% male. And the article was like, hey, guess what? That's a bad culture. And all of these stories of abuse from within it. There was a company called ArenaNet fired two of its developers, Jessica Price and Peter Fries, because they got in an argument with their audience on Twitter, basically. Jessica Fries was tweeting about an aspect of narrative design in the game because she's a narrative designer. And a guy who has a YouTube channel and has a lot of followers tweeted at her saying, really good thread, but if I could just disagree briefly, like I actually find this to be the case. And she tweeted, you know, today on the internet, guy telling me about a thing that I do, like I don't know how to do it. And immediately the guy was like, well, I'm appalled. I was just trying to have a conversation with you. And so she immediately started getting attacked, pushed back, and was fired. And then Peter Fries was fired for defending her. So games companies are still navigating how to like handle this and how to deal with this. Idea that like their developers are people and they might want to have a relationship with their fans, but they also might not want to just get stuff explained to them all day by people who aren't in their field. Mm-hmm. The upside of the alt-right happening and Trump getting elected and all of that
something
is that
you may be cautiously optimistic about.
Oh, no, I didn't go that far.
Oh, no. It doesn't fit into our soft category.
No, it's more that the pretense of a lot of this has been stripped away. To the extent to where there is currently a Comicsgate happening, which is in the comics industry.
Oh.
These guys, though, aren't even pretending to be in it for anything other than they don't want minorities and women in their comics.
At least they're honest.
At least they're out there.
I'll take them.
So that's currently boiling away. People are now having conversations specifically around representation, which is like the babyest baby step forward, but it is at least... it's happening in a way that can be talked about. And some companies are pushing back harder. I think the Battlefield games, which are like set in World War II, put out a trailer for Battlefield 4 that involved a woman soldier. And people started being like, well, historical accuracy. And like, this is a game where like you can ride a plane down and then jump from the plane onto a Jeep and like fire a machine gun from a camel.
Always that when people say that, I'm like, when you get shot, you don't die, right?
Right? Yeah. Right?
So we're done with this conversation?
So check. But yeah, they put it out. People were like, meh, that. And the company was basically like, okay, Bye. Yeah. Like they, companies are starting to learn the bad faith of those kinds of arguments and just ignoring them, which is nice. And then, that's sort of the whole thing in a nutshell.
What an awful nut.
It's a terrible, disgusting nut.
Oh, God.
Zoe Quinn's book, Crash Override, is amazing. It's also the name of an advocacy group she has started that is basically a support network for online abuse, which has all sorts of references if you're being abused.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah,
wow. That exists.
It's worth checking out. It's a lot about like prevention and then what to do when it's happening. It has a further, her memoir has a further reading section with a lot of awesome people. Maddie Bryce, who is one of the critics who was attacked, also has like a further reading section on her website that's really cool. Feminist Frequency is amazing. Brianna Wu just ran for Congress.
Brianna.
Yeah, I know, right? And is staying really like advocacy related to digital security. So, you know, everybody involved, everybody who was targeted by this movement has owned their relationship to it and found ways to move past it, but move past it in positive ways for the most part, except the people we don't hear about, right. Which is the sad part about it. Things you can do to keep from being abused. This is your homework. You guys need to update your passwords.
Oh.
I listened to your dark web episode.
And when people naturally come after us for airing this episode, we're going to get my identity stolen for what will probably be the fourth time. So.
Oh, no. Two things you can do for yourself now.
We're going to do that.
You and everybody listening, get a password manager.
What does that mean?
What's a password
manager? So a password manager, I use LastPass. It's amazing. There's also 1Password and KeePass. It is basically a plugin for your for web browser. There's a local version. This is going to sound unsecure until I talk you through it. It is basically a storage vault for all of your passwords.
Mm-hmm.
So the goal is that you only ever have to remember a password.
Mm.
You should make it a very, very good password. But if you lose that password, the company can't help you because they don't have it either. It's everyone's vault is encrypted using a specific hash that is specific to them and that the company does not store. So you are basically creating a little safe for yourself that is on your phone, can be on your phone, on your browser, can be anywhere that you're sitting down, can be accessed to give you all of your passwords. It also does things like it generates passwords for you. So you don't have to make stuff up. It will do a health check of all of your passwords to be like, hey, what's repetitive? What have you had for a while? What should you change? It tries to make it as easy as possible to keep secure passwords, because that's the best first line of defense. And the second one is two-factor authentication, which is...
Oh, they make me do that at work.
Yeah. You should do that. Do you have it on your personal Gmail? Now? When this episode goes up? By the time this episode goes up?
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Don't even try. Don't even try, hackers.
Yeah.
But yeah, password security is like worth a whole other episode sometime, because I can send you some really terrifying articles about it.
Do it.
Yeah. So those are like some basic steps that are good. And it's mostly, I mean, Quinn's memoir is amazing. And one of the things it drives home is just to have a plan for like, oh, something is weird. What do I do? Like, no, it's like doing a fire drill. Just knowing what you do if this very real possible threat in today's culture happens to you. Because like you said, there's a creativity that comes with isolation and boredom and malevolence. And so the threshold that it takes for someone to like decide they're just going to try to hack an account is incredibly low. And it has more to do with like what they're doing that day than it does with how much they hate you or not, because it's like a game, but a bad game that no one should play.
Yeah. I didn't even think about that. Like, it's like a game to them because that's the world, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Ooh. It is gamified, and there are rewards and there's bragging rights and there's all sorts of stuff. So, everybody, get a password manager and do two-factor authentication. And don't use hashtag Gamergate in your tweets. It's not worth it. Yeah.
I would love for you to quickly explain, because we chatted about Gamergate before, how you got into this topic, why you know so much about it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
How non-player character became a thing that you made.
That can move into cautious optimism.
Yeah, cautious optimism.
Yeah. No, I... I've always been a gamer. I love games. I'm like, and games of all kinds. I love indie games. I love shooters. I just love them. I get deeply addicted to them, and it's a very big problem. It's why I don't have a console right now, because I would not be here right now.
Right.
I'd be playing Breath of the Wild. When Gamergate happened, I was in Chicago for a wedding when Sarkeesian canceled her speaking event. And I remember like being in the Airbnb my wife and I were renting, and just following this obsessively, because it was like all of it, like I'd seen some of it getting talked about earlier, but then all of a sudden it was all anybody was talking about. And it was this huge sort of come to Jesus moment for games, having a very similar conversation that I think theater had been having for a while around mm-hmm. representation and diversity and equity, but having it with just no filter at all mm-hmm. and only anger. So I was just kind of riveted. And I think a lot of times with plays, I write a play when there's like something I really want to talk about. And this was something I really wanted to talk about. And it became a fun thought exercise on how to write a play about this thing that most people seeing a play don't know about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, initially, the play's about a game designer named Katya, who's just starting out. And she sort of, through a couple different events, winds up becoming a target of abuse. And she's very much in the category of like people who are too small to be a big deal. Mm-hmm. So it's not a play about Gamergate specifically. It's not trying to recapture that story or try to own that story. It's just trying to talk about abuse online and the way that you can fall into it and be exposed to it. And it's been really fascinating. We did a workshop of it in San Francisco, which was great because I got to hang out and talk to a lot of people in the games industry about it. And then we did a production of it last January. And it was really cool. I think there were some Twitter issues, but this is like, again, this is how dumb this movement is. Nobody tweeted at the theater. They all went after a female reporter who wrote a review of the play because she mentioned Gamergate in the headline of the play. And that got like 300 tweets of abuse. But like I didn't get anything. The theater producing it didn't get anything. Like it was just, it's so stupid and asymmetrical. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a fun play. It is a comedy despite being about depressing stuff. A lot of it is set inside of a video game. It's going to be going up in Chicago next spring.
Exciting.
Yeah. So it's been fun. And it's been cool to talk to game designers through it mm-hmm. and through working on it, especially because, I mean, the good news is that Gamergate is losing and video games as a field are going through this real kind of artistic renaissance where people are really thinking about the fact that this is a medium that is all about empathy mm-hmm. when it's used correctly. You're putting a player into someone else's identity and having them view the world and interact with the world through that lens. And it's so cool to see what people are doing with that. In addition to changing all your passwords, I would say if you have an iPhone or an Android phone, there's a game called Florence. Florence, that is like, it'll take you maybe 40 minutes to play. I sobbed through most of it.
Ooh.
And it's just like, it's basically an interactive storybook, but the way that it uses the interface of the game to establish character and establish narrative and establish emotion is gorgeous and is just like striking. And it's for me like one of the best examples of what a game can do as far as attaching you to a character's point of view. Mm-hmm. And ideally, if people start pushing in that direction, games can actually become a medium that is used to encourage and increase empathy and put people into perspectives where they have not been before. Like there's a game that's available on Steam called Papers, Please, where you play a border agent of a totalitarian company. And you have to approve or deny entry to refugees, essentially. And it is a
that's like that episode we did about the Milgram experiment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like putting you in
yep.
that.
Yeah,
but you at least know it's not real,
right?
But, and that's such a tool. Like
yeah.
what we as you know writers and all that kind of stuff as playwrights and musicians and novelists try to do with a narrative art form.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. the fact that it could be gamified, like you said.
Yeah, like it makes you feel terrible because you're sitting like you have to decide, you know, you can let people in, but you'll get fired. And so, mm-hmm. like, you have to be really careful about it. And it's such a revelatory experience. And it's the kind of thing that you can only do in games, mm-hmm. especially now that, like, VR is becoming a thing and virtual reality is, like, all about identity and empathy. But, yeah, it's a field that I'm really passionate about and excited by. And just, it's so on the cusp of being so much better than it has been. So I think it's moving into something that where Gamergate was firmly in the past. But, you know, the abuse is always going to be there until social media figures that out and everything. But at least it feels like gaming as a field is starting to figure out how to recover from something like that.
Wow. That's exciting. I feel excited about.
Yeah.
I am cautious. Yeah, I am cautiously optimistic.
Yay. I did it. We made the turn.
You did it. You earned the ding. You made the cautiously optimistic. You're hitting every check mark.
You're an expert.
On the I'm Horrified boxes. You're killing it. Well, thank you so much for giving us all of this incredible information. So many things I didn't know, especially, like, I did not at all consider the people who weren't a teensy bit famous. Like, most of what I knew was about Anita Sarkeesian.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I watched her video, so I was kind of connected to her, and I didn't think at all, because I was kind of like, oh, this ties into sort of the prices of fame, not as an excuse, but, like, how people given a little bit of the spotlight, and I was really thinking about it through that lens, and it's like, no, anyone with any opinion or even no opinion at all who just has a similar identity is going to be smacked in the face with that as well.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, and that's been happening forever.
That's been happening since dawn of games, I'm sure.
And so, yeah, it's not great, but there are luckily
we'll get better.
Yeah, and there are way more resources out there now, which is great.
That's amazing. So we'll be sure to plug all of those in ways we'll think about thoughtfully.
We'll have this conversation.
We have a little bit of time left. Should we do some quick, Walt? I'm not sure if you know, when we have a guest such as yourself, we do quick episode recaps from past episodes.
Ooh. Yeah, I have a couple of the quickest updates.
Give me them.
Yeah, here's a couple of very quick ones.
Give us updates.
From episode 21, the Clinton Lewinsky scandal and the Capuchin catacombs. There is another great podcast now that is covering the Clinton Lewinsky scandal, and it's season 2 of a podcast called Slow Burn. And season 1, they talked about Watergate in season 1, which was great.
Wow. They're and just then, like, steering right into the distressingly topical side of the world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then this next, this one they did, Clinton Lewinsky scandal. And then who knows, for the next one, maybe they'll talk about Warren G. Harding. Like, I'm excited to see.
If we at them enough on Twitter, they gotta.
It's law. That's canon law.
And then the last one, from episode 5, The Execution of the Romanovs and The Bachelor. Becca, who was dumped by Ari, a piece of garbage, fire, trash, live on TV, has found love. She was the bachelorette this last season. And
new love has sprung in
her life? Yes. She chose this guy named Garrett. And he seems like he sucks a little bit. But if she's happy, I'm happy. Even though it does seem like he liked a bunch of conservative memes on Instagram.
Oh, no.
He's since apologized. I hope he's learned. I hope she's happy. And Ari is still a dumpster fire person. But those are my very quick updates. Allie, do you have any updates?
I'm glad you had something bad to say about Ari, as we hate him.
Yes.
But
it's only fair.
Yeah. Fuck that guy.
I have a couple. Episode 24. Remember how much fun we had talking about the capitalistic sinkhole? We're not going to talk about sinkholes. Capitalistic black hole that is Lululemon.
Yes.
Well, I found out something that will remind us of all those good times. Do we all remember Chip Wilson?
He sucks and he's a libertarian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The founder of Lululemon and lover of all things Ayn Rand.
Yes.
News broke last week that he will be releasing a book.
Oh, no.
Why?
I just felt that through my whole body.
I know what the title is. Any thoughts on what the title is? Any ideas?
Paddle Your Own Canoe.
Good
one. When life gives you Lululemons.
Whoa.
He should steal that. He should buy that from you. It's actually called Little Black Stretchy Pants.
Oh, no.
And it's a direct reference to the controversy about when he said that some women are too fat for leggings.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Why would you want to lean into that?
So
hey, everybody, remember this?
Remember when I sucked? I still do.
But I didn't know this, that's what actually encouraged him to step down as CEO. I don't think I even mentioned that. But now he's back for more, and I couldn't be less interested.
No.
So thank God. And the other thing I wanted to talk about is everybody's favorite segment, which is pimple popping on episode 28.
Why are you doing this to me?
Which everyone just has a visceral reaction.
Look how comfortable Walt is. I listened to that one at lunch. At lunch.
Oh, Walt. We put it in the title, so I do not feel bad for you, Niota.
Look, it just came up. It was the next one on the playlist.
But the thought of you listening to the podcast at your workplace makes us very happy.
Thanks, Walt.
So I'm going to have to do something that I truly never thought I would have to do, and that is quote Fox News. And I'm not proud of it, but they were the only ones who got the scoop on this one, so kudos to them. Fox News did an interview with Dr. Sandra Lee a few weeks ago and asked her, what I have to admit are some good questions that I wanted to know about. The first one being, are there any conditions under which someone should absolutely not pop a pimple?
Good question.
And yeah. I assumed her answer would have to be no, go for it, because she's Dr. Pimple Popper.
Right. Like, that's her thing.
That is her whole thing.
It's her brand.
And what she said was, quote, if you have tried to pop something and it doesn't pop after 30 seconds, you need to stop. You need to put your hands down and forget about it. End quote.
Disagree.
Wow.
So you heard it here first. That
ship has sailed.
Yeah. That is dermatological advice.
All right. All I'm going to say is I believe that you just have to want it.
I agree. You just got to work hard.
Yeah. Never give up on your dreams.
Exactly.
You know?
Never. We encourage you to go for it here, no matter what it is. So the other question that they asked her was, what's the strangest request you've ever gotten from a patient? To which she replied, in one case, I had a liposuction patient who wanted to keep her own fat to train her cadaver dog to find other dead bodies.
I like that. That's recycling.
No, Sam.
I'm not going to say it's not practical. I'm more shaken by the awareness that there is a cadaver dog. Like, is that a breed?
No, you train dogs to find dead bodies.
But, like, was she a hobbyist or was she, like, working for the police department?
I would think if she was working for the police department, she would have had access to a cadaver.
Yeah.
I like the idea that she showed them a badge, but then they realized it had a little teddy bear on it and that she actually bought it at, like, a children's store and that she was a murderer. The other thing that she said was, I had another woman who requested that she receive part of her lipoma to plant under her rose bush to act as a fertilizer. And then she furthermore said, which is fine. I took a portion of it and had it shipped.
Wow.
Wow, there was shipping involved. Yeah, it wasn't even service. Like I brought this Tupperware.
I mean, Sandra Lee, say what you will about her profession, is a very lovely woman.
Good for
She's
her.
A very yeah. kind person. But yeah, I dare not say anymore because your faces look so terrified. But I'll wrap up by, again, thanking you so much, Walt, for being here.
Thanks
You're the best,
me.
Walt.
Where can we find you and where can we find Crossover Appeal?
Absolutely. Crossover Appeal comes out every other Wednesday. We take two separate pop culture properties, like movies or books or TV, and we talk about them each individually, and then we cross them over together. The one that's coming out this week, this will be a sneak peek before the episode comes out, because it's coming out on Wednesday. We're going to do The Good Place and The Adventure Zone, which is a D&D podcast.
Exciting.
But yeah, we've done like Battlestar Galactica and Gilmore Girls and a bunch of other ones, and we basically just like figure out if there were fan fiction of these two as a crossover, what would it be?
Nice.
And we have a lot of fun. And that is at crossoverappealpodcast.tumblr.com or on Twitter at crossoverappeal. But yeah, and or on Facebook at Crossover Appeal Podcast. It's super fun. We have a good time doing it. I'm on Twitter at WMcGuy, so WMcGuy. That's hard to say out loud.
Yeah, and it's better to read.
Yeah.
And you lovely people can all do that when you go visit.
Oh, yeah.
It's true.
Social media.
You can get the pleasure of reading it for yourself.
Mm-hmm. And I just did an audio play series with the Huntington that's a Sherlock Holmes story.
Yes, where can we find that?
If you go to huntingtontheater.org/fog, it was this really weird project that was super fun where I got to write an original Sherlock Holmes story that is written to be listened to while walking through these fog sculptures on the Emerald Necklace, but you can also listen to them wherever because they're fun.
But if you're Boston-based, walk through the Emerald
Necklace. You should go through the fog because it's really cool.
That's awesome. Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. And then I'm at waltmcgough.com for plays and stuff.
Do you feel horrified?
Yes.
Is it coursing through your body?
But more because of your update than because of anything else.
You're welcome. Doing my job. Well, thank you again. We really appreciate you coming here and sharing this terrible stuff with us, but hopefully it's going to move in a wonderful direction. Hopefully you'll maybe come back to give us updates about video games are fixed.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's over. All misogyny is over.
I'll just come in and tell you what games to play.
Yep. But until that time, we hope you stay horrified.
Stay horrified.
Stay horrified.
I'm Horrified is a Hemlock Creatives production, recorded and produced by us, Sam Bierstow and Allie Gavin, in Boston, Massachusetts. Our art is by Leah Brilliard and Allie Gavin. You can find us on Twitter at @I'mHorrifiedPod and at @I'mHorrifiedPodcast.com. And you can tell us what horrifies you at I'mHorrifiedPodcast@gmail.com. If you'd like to support us directly on Patreon, you can get our podcast early and ad-free, as well as bonus episodes of our members-only minicasts, I'm Thrilled! Check us out at patreon.com/I'mHorrified. And if you liked hanging out with us, tell your friends, share us on your socials, and leave us a review wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for stopping by, Horror Honeys.